Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and I'm here with co-host Katie Wang.
Good to be here.
And joining us for the second half of the show today is Nick Scow. He's the conservation director at the Utah Rivers Council, and is going to be talking with us about their rain harvest program, which has been going on for years, as well as the new phase that they're launching this spring. So, Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Nell and Katie. Great to be with you.
Well, let's start by talking about this rain harvest program. Tell us what it is and when you started it.
Yeah, so we started the program in 2015, and what we do is we partner with municipalities to have them help lower the cost of rain barrels for their residents. And the goal of the program is really to help people conserve water and improve water quality in our communities. You know, really across the West, the most successful water conservation programs, you know, are incentive-based. A lot of people think conservation is hard, but really we're just giving people the tools they need to do their part in their own backyards.
So tell us about the impacts that, you know, a rain barrel can have. How, in what way does it, you know, improve water quality?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously they can help conserve water because we're, you know, it's been raining a lot lately and people can capture the water in rain barrels and use it outdoor on landscapes. And that water would otherwise run down people's downspouts, go across gutters, streets, sidewalks. And that's where it picks up urban pollutants as it enters our stormwater systems and gets rushed straight out to our water bodies. So a lot of people don't realize that runoff pollution is the number one source of urban water pollution nationwide. It's not industries and it's not farming and things. So rain barrels can help reduce the amount of water that's going across these urban non-porous surfaces. And then that water gets released into our landscapes over the next several days or weeks. And that more closely mimics the natural hydrological cycle. It's good for groundwater, and it's really good for our rivers. Why we're excited about this is that every time you're using your rain barrel, you're not turning on your hose or your sprinklers. And what a lot of people aren't thinking about is that the water that comes out of your hose and your sprinklers, in most cases, was diverted out of a river in the first place. So the less water we use from the municipal systems, the more water can stay in our rivers and support the really important ecosystems that need that water to survive.
There's also that added benefit of not using treated water, right? So rather, when you turn on your sprinkler system or your hose, you're often using essentially drinking water to water your lawn or your landscape, whereas the rain barrel sort of avoids that energy expenditure, right?
That's right. So we're helping to save energy. That's the water-energy nexus, because the culinary water you know, it takes a lot of energy to treat and transport. And additionally, we add salts and chlorine and fluoride and things to our drinking water, which are not in rainwater. Rainwater is very high in nitrogen and doesn't have these salts and things. So plants really love it. I don't think it's really any mystery to people who are gardeners that plants love the rain, but it's not just because it's water. It also has to do with the quality of the water, and it can be really beneficial for our landscapes.
So, Nick, how much water are we able to capture? I remember, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, it was illegal to capture water from the sky because all water is owned out here in the West, as we were just talking about the Glen Canyon Dam. But so now, certainly the laws have changed, but just looking at your website, it seems like there is a limit, but it's, you know, not a barrier. It's just kind of more of a process if you go above whatever the limit is.
Yeah, that's right, and it's still the number one question I get is, are you sure this is legal? It has been since 2010, and that allows anyone to collect up to 2,500 gallons per parcel at any given time. So that's not annually. That means you can have that much water on hand. These barrels that we offer through the Rain Harvest Program, people can go and look at them on our website at utahrivers.org, and they are 50-gallon barrels. And so now that we've been doing this since 2015, we've gotten over 3,300 rain barrels out in communities across northern Utah. And that means every time it rains enough to fill a 50-gallon barrel, we're saving 165,000 gallons of water. You know, and these rain barrels will last for many, many years, and that will become millions of gallons over time. So while rain barrels certainly aren't the silver bullet, you know, the one thing we can do to conserve water, they're a really great tool. And really communities across the West and really across the U.S. are embracing this, trying to make them available for their residents. And they're a really good tool that we can use.
It's kind of interesting. It's kind of like the old new technology, right? I mean, rain barrels have been around for hundreds of years, and I'm from the East Coast, so the idea that it was illegal was kind of confounding to me. But just looking at your website, I mean, you can link them together. I mean, it's just such a basic idea that you can capture water from the sky, water your lawn, hopefully not, but maybe your plants. And I was also interested to hear that Utahns are the highest per capita users of water for irrigation, which I thought was kind of shocking and saddening. but why is that? Why are we so obsessed with our green lawns? Because presumably that's where it's going.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a really dubious distinction that we have as the highest per person water users in the United States. And according to the state, our water use is somewhere up around 295 gallons per person per day.
Wow.
You know, the average is down closer to 140. Communities like Los Angeles are using 120, you know, so we have a real long way to go. And conservation is like creating a new water source. You know, that's how we're one of the big ways we're going to have enough water to grow in the future. And so, yeah, rain barrels have been around for a long time. And the East Coast, it's pretty commonplace. Communities like Santa Fe and Albuquerque require rainwater harvesting catchment systems in new building.
Wow.
And really, farmers were the original rainwater harvesters. And so, you know, the limit that we have at 2,500 gallons really came out of passing the legislation to legalize it, and there were people concerned that it would impact their own water rights, people drawing groundwater. But all the research I've seen has shown that widespread rainwater harvesting can actually help to boost groundwater supplies, because rather than, you know, shepherding the water right out through storm drains and out to our water bodies, it actually goes into the ground, becomes part of the groundwater cycle, and obviously we're taking less out of our streams and ecosystems.
So at what point can you actually start to see, like, a measurable difference? You know, does 3,300 rain barrels do it? Is there an example from some of these other communities you've mentioned where, you know, they've instituted new programs and now they're seeing a little bit of a difference with their water use and water availability?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, on the small scale, part of the reason rain barrels are great is that they really help to connect people to their water use and teach people how their water use is connected to our rivers and lakes and ecosystems. You know, people, our research has shown that when people harvest the rain, they pay more attention to when it rains, to snowpack. They tend to water plants less because they pay more attention to how much they really need. As far as really making a huge difference, we have a preliminary model that we did with a professor in class at Utah Valley University that shows just in the Salt Lake City area alone, we could be collecting up to 400 million gallons of rainwater every year.
Wow.
And that's just on residences. So if you include the industrial sector and places like the University of Utah, it could be really, really significant. It's something we're trying to look at long-term and working, you know, with GIS capabilities and things to kind of track where our barrels are, and then using that crossing with precipitation data to show really how much we've captured. But I think that, you know, you're going to see more and more of it, and especially when we branch out into the industrial sector, that can be really big. One of the prohibitions is that it's kind of expensive to retrofit, you know, big buildings with large cisterns. But when you do it in new construction, it can be easily incorporated. What we're really limited by right now is, on that sector, is the 2,500 gallon limit. If businesses were able to trap up to like 10,000 gallons at a time, they could actually subsist year-round with just rainwater, and also with melting snow off the buildings. And a colleague of mine that's an architect here in the Valley has actually documented this at one of their offices in California, where they're able to capture more water.
Wow, that's exciting to hear. It's inspirational, even if we're not there yet. If you are just joining us, we're talking with Nick Scow, who is the conservation director at the Utah Rivers Council, about their rain harvest program. Nick, if you can hang on for a minute, we are going to take a quick break for a couple of underwriters and then come back to keep talking about water conservation.
Sounds great.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
Hi, this is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We proudly support KPCW and many other local nonprofits. We have been supporting the local community and providing real estate services since 1976. All current and active listings can be found on our website at bhhsutah.com.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
I'm Katie Wang.
And on the phone with us for this second half of the show is Nick Scow, the conservation director at Utah Rivers Council. And we are currently talking all things rain barrel water conservation methods. So Nick, we wanted to talk a little bit more about the current program that you have running with these rain barrels that you just announced.
Sure. So we are partnering on this program with the Salt Lake County Watershed Division and our newest city down here, Mill Creek City. And we have are offering discounted barrels in a limited quantity for $50 each. There's still some available for each residents of each municipality. But in addition to that, anybody, anywhere, even residents up there in Park City and Summit County can get some of these awesome rain barrels at the cost of $75 per barrel. That's still significantly discounted, down from $129 retail price. And so the sale is live right now, and people can go and pre-order rain barrels by visiting our website, utahrivers.org. And then we'll be having all the barrels be delivered and distributed on June 9th down here in the Salt Lake Valley. So it's a it's been a really fun program. Every time we offer it, we have a lot of interest. And I think that really reflects how people are eager to do more. And they see that we have a low snowpack this year and that it's going to be, you know, really a pressing water situation. And lately, it's just the barrels have been flying off the shelf, so to speak.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the barrels themselves? If you haven't been to the website, I think it's pretty interesting. I mean, again, you know, East Coast, I'm thinking, you know, whiskey barrel filled with water,
right.
Kind of scummy at the top, a little bit dangerous probably. But this is not what you're selling. You're selling something that's certainly the updated new age, much more technically, you know, adept version of the rain barrel.
Right. And, you know, for a long time, the only way to really get into this was to make your own barrels. I know that's how my wife and I started with, you know, the old used Coke barrels from Coca-Cola, and they smell like, you know, Country Time lemonade when you first fill them up. But no one has to have really any tools or anything for these barrels. They're very user-friendly and extremely popular. So these barrels are called the Ivy Rain Barrel. They're 100% recycled plastic. And they have all the bells and whistles, a screen on top on the lid, which keeps debris and mosquitoes out. They have a valve that you can just put in the bottom. It's a 3/4-inch ball valve that hooks to a standard garden hose. You can lock the lid if you're worried about kids or critters getting in there. And you can actually daisy chain several barrels together and fill them from the same downspout. And that's been something pretty popular. We've had many people who've come back for more barrels each year that liked them and said, well, wait, I could be collecting way more water. and so I you know, and the other thing is they're really easy to transport and store. They actually stack inside each other. I helped someone put three on the back seat of a Prius the other day. So it's
all right.
you don't need a big SUV. That's good.
Yeah, and that's the whole point is, you know, we want to make this really simple and easy for people. We want to show people that conserving water is not a hardship, and it can actually really be simple and obtainable by anyone. And part of that is why we're really happy to partner with municipalities to lower the cost of these barrels for residents, because it's not accessible necessarily for everybody. You know, if someone has a lot of money and they want to get rain barrels, there are some really cool like wooden wine barrels that come out of Sonoma, you know.
Does it taste like wine? Your Chardonnay water.
It must. So, you know, you can really, people who are doing cisterns will have large galvanized systems, and there's a whole host of things available, but we went with this rain barrel to really have it, you know, be safe for municipalities, no mosquitoes, nothing like that, and then also to have it be very user-friendly for residents.
So well, I can speak from experience on this. We just got a rain barrel for our house that we'll be installing, and it looks very slick, has all the parts, and seems like it'll be relatively easy to install. It's the Ivy rain barrel, like Nick mentioned, so... wish us luck to get some rain after we get it installed finally.
I know. Well, and if anyone has any questions, you know, or wants to see more, then go to our website or they can call me at Rivers Council. I love talking to people about this and helping people get started on the journey of rainwater harvesting.
So, Nick, just to since I run a nonprofit as well, I know money does not grow on trees, sadly. So how are you able to subsidize these? Do you raise funding from sponsors, grants? Do people contribute to this? Like, how can other people get involved? Say you have you've reached your capacity and you want to help other people do the same. Can people get involved in that sense financially?
Yeah, so that's why we partner with the municipalities. So they're basically providing a direct subsidy to their residents for each barrel. So it's basically a $25 per barrel subsidy to lower it to the $50 cost. And then, you know, we're offering them basically just at our cost at $75 for everyone else, because we just want to get the barrels out there. It's not necessarily a program that we use for any sort of funding mechanism. We look at it more as an outreach program and a way to kind of continue to promote alternatives to big, expensive water development projects, which Utah is proposing. And so part of what we do is engage in policy and programs like this and partner with cities. And that's been really excellent, because we've formed now 8 really great relationships with cities and counties that we've partnered with. But really, they're just lowering the cost for their residents, and then everyone else is picking up the rest of the cost with the $50.
And so what else can we do in water conservation? Certainly capturing it, you know, reusing what's coming from the sky. There's certainly the benefit of not using culinary-grade water. But, you know, conservation is certainly, education about conservation is certainly a major component of this. How can we use less water? What are some tips that you give out to people as we enter into what looks like it's going to be a pretty dry summer?
Sure. So the biggest thing is that we're using about 72% of our water annually outside the home. And that's just based on the average Utah resident.
And so, that's not agriculture, right? Just to hammer
yeah,
that point
correct.
Home.
That's, right. That's just washing your car.
That's just what they call M&I, which is municipal and industrial water use. And so that means that we really have a lot of low-hanging fruit. In many cases, what people can do to make a difference is just eliminate waste. So, you know, down here in the valley, a lot of people have parking strips, which is the area of grass in between the street and the sidewalk. Really hard to water, not really used for anything. We have guidance on our website about how people can rip that turf out and, you know, put in drought-tolerant flowers and other plants. But really, I always point people to starting outside the home. So primarily, we're using that water on lawns, so people can actually, and we have advice on how to do this at our webpage as well, but really just watering fewer times a week, only watering after 6 p.m. at night and before 10 a.m. in the morning. and then having a little bit longer watering cycles, but then only watering 2 days a week instead of 4 days a week. What that helps your turf do is, you know, reach its roots down deeper and be more resilient. And I think that we really just see a lot of overwatering. You know, if the average patch of Kentucky bluegrass needs around 30 inches of water a year, what the state found in one of their studies is that people are actually putting about 60 inches on it.
Wow.
So people could reduce their watering by about half and still have really healthy lawns.
So they'd still have that green patch that the, you know, the American
right.
dream.
Yeah, the other thing people can do is, you know, convert over to drip systems. The state is actually offering rebates this year for smart water timers. So you can get some of these new water timers for your sprinkler system and everything that will shut off when it rains. Or you can actually, some of them have a soil sensor, and when they sense the soil is moist, they won't turn on.
Wow.
So there's a lot of more sophisticated options for that, but really people should just focus on outside the home. At our website, we've also got ways for people to reduce indoor water use, but you know, before telling people they need to take shorter showers, I would prefer that we really change our landscape practices and you know, really just have turf where we need it rather than parking strips and sometimes in commercial sectors where it's really not used. You know, down here in the valley, there are still communities and HOAs that require people to plant turf grass or a certain percentage of it. And it's really absurd when you just go to other large, fastly growing cities in the Southwest where there's very little turf grass, a lot of beautiful drought-tolerant landscaping. And that doesn't mean that people have no grass. You know, there's still small lawns. I mean, I have a dog and kids, so I have a little bit of grass as well. It's not like you have to be very draconian. But just small adjustments like that to how we're landscaping and how we're using our water can actually make a really big difference.
And I think that's an important point. People think xeriscape, they mispronounce it as zero scaping, that it
right.
all has to be this, you know, it's got to be rocks, and which actually has an adverse effect, right? You can create these heat islands. You
right.
do want some vegetation to absorb that heat and, you know, evaporation, you know, the whole water cycle concept, but that you can have beautiful native grasses, you know, maybe some lawn, but small lawn, and maybe not Kentucky bluegrass.
Yeah, and we actually have a lot of beautiful native plants that do really well here in northern Utah. You know, my whole front lawn is full of them, and I don't water out there at all. And there's butterflies and bees, and you know, so there's a lot of really gorgeous flowers, grasses, and bushes that really almost need no water at all once they're well established. And you're right. I mean, there's just a really this kind of misunderstanding that water conservation is going to be, you know, this draconian restriction of people's property rights, but it really doesn't have to be that way. We have some of the poorest water conservation goals anywhere in the U.S., and a legislative audit from 2015 found that the state is really just proposing to reduce water use by 1% per year until the year 2025, and then nothing after that. By contrast, you know, cities like Los Angeles reduced water use 20% in 1 year recently because of a really intense drought. So we're really decades behind other Western states, and this is the low-hanging fruit. We have several good alternatives to building billions of dollars in new water infrastructure that are really environmentally destructive. And things like water conservation and, you know, using surplus agricultural water that's not being used, those are ways that we can provide plenty of water for our growing communities.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left. And you mentioned, you know, some of these enormous water infrastructure projects, one of which has to do with the Bear River. And on your website, you list the top 10 reasons that northern Utah cities aren't running out of water in relation to that project. So tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So the Bear River Development Project is one of the largest new river diversions proposed anywhere in North America. And this would have really big impacts on the Great Salt Lake because the Bear River provides up to 70% of the surface water inflows to the lake. The lake is home to 10 million birds on an average year across 230 species. Some of them gather there in larger numbers than anywhere else on the planet. And so before we do this, we really should be looking at other water conservation proposals. The thing that really amazes me is that this is projected as a need. You know, people, I go give a talk somewhere and I ask how many people have been told we're running out of water, and the whole room raises their hand. But it's just really not the truth. We have the highest per person water use in the U.S., and still there have been no documentation showing any actual need for projects like the Bear River Development Project and the Lake Powell Pipeline. You know, it's another thing if they had really good, solid numbers and said, we need this water, but it's just not the case. We have a long way to go with conservation. We have most of our growth is happening on farmland, which means that a lot of water that we've used historically for farming is then becoming available for the municipal sector. And to put it another way, legislative auditors said our municipal water supply is growing. And that's not being reported to policymakers and decision makers. And that's because there are entities that want to build these water projects. This is big spending proposals. And we're talking about billions of dollars in spending and construction that will benefit certain special interests.
Well, Nick, I unfortunately have to start to wrap things up. We could talk about water in Utah all day, definitely. But I do want to note that there's tons of information on utahrivers.org about each of these topics that we've covered. How can our listeners get involved if they're interested in learning more?
Go to utahrivers.org. People can get involved by volunteering. We'll let people know about hearings and ways that they can get more involved in the decision-making process. If people don't have time, they can also just donate to ensure that we have staff time to be there and to advocate on behalf of our rivers and freshwater ecosystems. But yeah, there's a lot of information there, and they can also call us here at the office.
Well, fantastic. Nick, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That was Nick Scow, the Conservation Director at the Utah Rivers Council. We'll take a quick break for some underwriters before we wrap up the show.
Quarterly Summit Community Power Works reports, During This Green Earth is brought to you in part by Rocky Mountain Power. Being energy efficient is good for you and the Wasatch Back. Being mindful of how you use energy makes our community better. More information on how to make a difference at watsmart.com.